Frank Sinatra from the Rat Pack. Daniel Glass joins us on the program. Drummer, historian, the author of The Commandments of Early Rhythms and Blues Drumming. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Trevor. How are you?
Hey, Daniel, I was about to say to you, wow, what an amazing orchestration that Frank Sinatra had behind him. And then I looked at the CD.
Yep. Count Basie Orchestra, conducted by none other than Quincy Jones. And that's an incredibly famous recording of Sinatra at the Sands in Vegas, you know, in the 60s, doing what he did best. One of the reasons that we consider him to be probably, you know, the greatest entertainer of the 20th century.
But
one of them.
And I mean, I know he's amazing, but how you can't go far wrong with orchestration like that behind you, because it was so tight. It was beautiful to listen to.
Yeah, it sure was. And I wanted to start with that track because I guess we're talking about the Rat Pack today. And, you know, the Rat Pack centers around Vegas and what was happening in Vegas at that time period, what was happening in Sinatra's life in that time period. A lot of very, very interesting things, you know, that were going on at that time. But that particular track just sort of summarizes what makes Frank Sinatra so incredible, you know. And of course, with Count Basie Band, who were at, you know, a later phase of their career, but at a very high point as well. Quincy Jones, you know, the legendary producer and arranger, who worked, of course, with Michael Jackson and many, many, many others. And he had been active since the 50s, actually. I mean, Quincy had a whole other career long before Michael Jackson. So, you know, working with people like Sinatra and Count Basie. And it's just about the most in-your-face big band type of a track, most swinging thing you could possibly imagine.
It's amazing.
Sinatra's delivery, his articulation, all of it's fantastic.
How did the Rat Pack form?
Well, the Rat Pack, the name the Rat Pack actually comes from an earlier time based around Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, who were married, of course, for a long time. And they sort of had a social club, for lack of a better word. There's a in the Holmby Hills area of New York, which was called the Holmby Hills Rat Pack. And it was sort of a place, you know, they would get together and party, essentially. And then they sort of created this kind of social club. And Sinatra was a member of that. And, of course, he was a younger man than Bogart. And so that sort of is where the name comes from originally. And then the version of the Rat Pack that we know today formed in Vegas, and it was sort of all of the main headlining guys in the group. Sammy Davis Jr., Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin were all performing actively in Vegas at this time period. This is sort of early 60s. And they would show up at each other's gigs. Sometimes it was unannounced. Sometimes they would literally put up on the marquee, Sinatra tonight, maybe Dino, maybe Sammy, you know. And so eventually it became sort of a real buzz, and people would camp out in their cars and show up, you know, at these various gigs. I mean, obviously these guys were at the peak of their form at this point anyway.
Hmm.
But you know, it was crazy if they showed up, so that's sort of how it started. They would just start showing up on each other's gigs in Vegas, and then it became more of a loose conglomeration. They were in movies together. The famous Ocean's 11, the original one, is the best example, and Robin and the Seven Hoods. And you know, it was very loose. It was very drink slinging everywhere. They just sort of, you know, took their bow ties off on stage and got politically incorrect with each other. And we'll play some of that music later so people can hear what the vibe is like live in Vegas.
Hazel joins us. Hello, Hazel.
Oh, hi, Trevor. Probably what I'm saying is more about Frank Sinatra, Lars Manelli, and Sammy Davis Jr.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was into the Rat Pack and saw all their shows, like the movies and that. But to get back to Frank Sinatra, he was my idol from when I was first into music, and I actually I saw him every time he was in Melbourne, and same with the other two. I live 4 hours from Melbourne, but never missed any of those shows.
Tell me about Sammy Davis.
Well, actually, the last time he was here, like he died only a few months after that. But no, I saw him at the old stadium, like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
But no, but Frank Sinatra has... I was actually in Vancouver with a friend staying there, and we'd been out for the day and got home. There's a message on the phone from my son saying, "Oh, I'm really sorry, Mum, but Frank Sinatra died today. Perhaps you could go back to LA to his funeral."
It'd be one of those things where people would remember. I'll come back to you in a second, Daniel. Hello, Janet.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I saw Sammy Davis in his first show at Sydney Stadium.
Hmm.
And he held the audience in his hand. He divided that huge audience into four, and he did a separate act for each quarter. He did the tap dancing for one quarter, and that was amazing, like Fred Astaire, Eat Your Heart Out. Then he got his six shooters out, and he did a full conjuring act with these revolvers. They went everywhere.
Hmm.
Then he played the piano, classical and rock, and sang for the other quarter, and the last quarter the light dimmed and then the spotlight came up on the stage, and you would have put money on the fact that that was Frank Sinatra sitting there, because he was a brilliant mimic, and he had the little trilby, he had the glass, he had the cigarette, and the voice, it was Frank. He sang all Frank's songs. What an entertainer. There's never been anybody like Sammy Davis Jr. since.
Janet, thank you. Is that one of the things about the Rat Pack, Daniel, is that you had the amazing voice of Sinatra, you had the very smooth Dean Martin, and you had the amazing entertainer of Sammy Davis Jr.?
Absolutely. I mean, it was they were each superstars in their own right, and so when they got together, it was out of hand. And Sam, and she's absolutely right. Sammy Davis Jr. was, he specialized in imitations. He could do anything. I think, you know, she mentioned working out with a six shooter. You know, he did all these tricks and such. And, you know, he had been a child star in his uncle's trio, the Will Mastin Trio is how Sammy got his start. And he was a phenom from a very early age. And you know, so many of those guys, you know, we might talk about Buddy Rich a little bit later in the show, the drummer Buddy Rich. He was a vaudeville performer from the time he was 18 months old. He was a star. They called him Traps, the Drum Wonder. So Sammy Davis Jr. came from that same era of you know, hardcore, inveterate showbiz folks. They just grew up in that world and did it their whole entire lives. And, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. was a quintuple threat, I guess you could say.
I remember, because being from Perth, he's a very generous guy. They used to do a telethon, an appeal-a-thon thing, and Sammy Davis came on there as a guest. And usually those guest performers would come on, do their song, and leave. And he stayed, and just stayed for hours and hours and hours and hours raising money. And for a little West Australian sort of appeal-a-thon, telethon thing, for someone like Sammy Davis to do it was incredibly generous.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Your first caller mentioned she got a telephone call from her son right after she got back from Los Angeles saying Sinatra had passed away. So the day of Sinatra's funeral, I went to the dentist in Beverly Hills, literally at the end of the block from the church where his funeral was being held. So I walked out of my dental appointment and looked up the street, and there was Sinatra's funeral. So I took a wander up there, you know, just on the outside of the church. But it was actually in quite a small church in Beverly Hills. But that's where I was the day of Sinatra's funeral.
Let's talk about another Sinatra song. You've chosen One for My Baby?
Yeah, One for My Baby. I mean, you know, this... again, focuses a little more on Sinatra, and you don't have to play this entire track. I just want to give people sort of the vibe. You know, Sinatra was, we heard the first track was all this sort of bombast and swagger with the Count Basie Orchestra. This track is the other side of Sinatra, the tender, kind of naked to the world, bearing his soul vulnerable Sinatra. And this is, you know, he had... we have to remember he started as a crooner with the big bands and singing ballads. He was no more as balladeer than he was a tough guy, you know. And this song, One for My Baby, is from, I believe it was first featured, Well, he sang it throughout his career many, many times, like he did Luck Be a Lady. Luck Be a Lady was originally in the stage musical Guys and Dolls, and he sings it in the movie. And One for My Baby, this is one of his signature songs. It's a beautiful ballad about a guy at a bar late at night, and he's kind of lost his girl. And you just hear the way Sinatra delivers it. It's spectacular.
Thank you very much. I'd like to...
Frank Sinatra, one of the Rat Pack, as we talk about them this morning, One for My Baby. Daniel Glass joins us this morning, drummer, author and historian who plays with the Royal Crown Review, who tour Australia quite regularly. Daniel, we'll talk about some other people apart from, but I've got a few texts here that I wanted to read out and get your comment. Shirley MacLaine was the only female honorary member.
She was the most famous, but I think, you know, others, Liza Minnelli, Marilyn Monroe, other sort of female starlets and singers of the time period, you know, were sort of honorary members. But yeah, Shirley MacLaine is well known. She was also an actress and a singer and a dancer. She was in films with the guys, so she's the best known for that, yeah.
Was Peter Lawford there?
Yes, the other two best known names are Peter Lawford, who was an actor who had been in movies with Sinatra, and Joey Bishop, who was another not as well-known singer, you know, actor, Vegas entertainer. And those guys were, you know, they were hanging out in Vegas, and they were in the movies. They were in the Ocean's 11 and Robin and Seven Hoods. And in fact, they all reunited again in Cannonball Run 2 in the 70s, believe it or not. I actually looked that up. But that was the last time they were all on screen together. And that was Frank, Dino, and Sammy, and Shirley MacLaine was in that as well. Yep. I wanted to just mention about that recording of One for My Baby, just to set up. It's an interesting story about Sinatra. And he had been, the reason, that was a live recording done in Paris in 1962. And Sinatra was really in a tough period in his life at that point, and this is part of the reason why the Rat Pack was such a new emergence for him. You know, he'd had a lot of success as a young man, and we sort of think of him as being a legend all the way through. But around this time period, he was in his star was sort of fading a little bit. You know, he'd done From Here to Eternity in the 50s and the big band stuff, and he was a teen idol, but he was getting older. And the election of 1960, the election of President John Kennedy here in America, Sinatra was very involved with that. And Peter Lawford, who you mentioned, was actually married to one of the Kennedys and got Sinatra to I think the Rat Pack actually performed at some kind of a fundraiser for John Kennedy. So Kennedy gets elected and is going to make this big visit to Palm Springs. And Sinatra, he's supposed to stay with Sinatra, this kind of payback for helping him to get elected. Well, it turns out that Sinatra's association with the mob sort of is brought to light because Robert Kennedy, JFK's brother, is hitting on the mob. That was one of his big things when they came into office. And so they snubbed Sinatra, and he didn't visit Sinatra. So Lawford and Sinatra never spoke again. Or didn't really hang out much after that, although Lawford was still, you know, part of this Rat Pack scene. So Sinatra, and he was having all these problems with Ava Gardner, you know, that was a torrid romance that he had. They married and they divorced, and so his reputation was also bad. So he, in the early 60s, took off and did this world tour with a sextet, and that's where this record in Paris was filmed. They played the Royal Albert Hall in London, and I believe they visited Australia at that time as well. Because there's recordings from all those different shows. So just a sort of a note. And so with this Vegas thing coming up, you know, it really kind of gave Sinatra a new life.
Dick joins us. Hello, Dick. You actually want to talk about Peter Lawford?
I seem to recall that he... Was he ever associated with one of the royal family? I might be confusing that with the Kennedys.
Peter Lawford.
Yeah.
I think you're thinking about the Kennedys.
Being the royal family of the United States.
Exactly, for lack of a better word.
Thanks very much, Dick. John, hello, John.
Yes. Still here?
Yes, John.
Did you want to speak to me or am I talking to you?
No, you could. Either way, John, you played with Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, no, I backed his band at the stadium. We did the Sinatra show, the Sammy Davis. They used to have the Mouseketeers, Liberace. I forget all of the Gene Krupa, Buddy Rich. they used to come out here, do shows at the stadium. I got the dates of more, because I had a book. For instance, Sinatra was here on the 31st of March, 59.
Now, John, what did you play?
I played in those days tenor sax.
Yeah.
And they used a scratch band of local musos who were pretty common blokes who could just read the music straight off. Sinatra, we did one rehearsal. He brought his own pianist. Sammy Davis was on the 20th of April, 49. Lee Gordon, the promoter, brought him out.
John, what were they like to play with? Were they good people?
Oh, look, Sammy Davis was tremendous. He'd out in the dressing room, he'd be showing off tricks with his air pistols. He used to switch on the lights and that with them. No, Sinatra wouldn't mix with the musos. of course, Louis Armstrong was different. They were all different. Johnny O'Keefe we didn't have much to do with, because that was a new noise coming on at that stage.
Yep.
But Mouseketeers we did. Liberace was probably the best of the lot. Liberace would do a session there where the audience would yell out requests, and it used to take about 20 minutes. And we decided while we're doing that, we might as well sneak out the back and have a game of we used to play cards out the back. And we're just sneaking out the orchestra pit one time while he did his act, and he stopped and he yelled out, "Hey, you'll come back, fellas, won't you?" John, that was typical Liberace. He was a good bloke.
John, thank you. I've just got to go back to Daniel. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
That's all right. All the best.
Thank you, John. Was that the case that Frank was a little bit cranky, but Sammy Davis Jr. was a pretty friendly sort of a fella, Daniel?
Well, yeah, I think, Sinatra was a little bit aloof. He was, he'd been a huge star, and he was surrounded by his guys, you know, so to speak. That's typically how stars like this that use the large orchestra, that's how they'll travel. They won't bring the whole orchestra with them. They'll bring a musical director and a few key, usually a rhythm section, so it swings the right way. And then they'll pick up, you know, strings and horns wherever they go. So God bless John, man. What an opportunity. I wish I'd had that opportunity.
What great people he played with. Let's talk a little bit about Dean Martin and what was happening in his life when the Rat Pack formed.
Well, it was sort of a similar thing. Dean Martin, you know, in the 40s had come about as a comedy team with Jerry Lewis. And a lot of people, again, forget that that was his early career. He was the smooth, suave, straight man, and Jerry Lewis, of course, was the clown, you know, the goofball. And they were a comedy team, and then they had a ton of hit movies and radio shows and television show together and everything. So, when Dean Martin broke away from that, he had a lot of success. He had then his own career in the 50s. But again, it was sort of, you know, where do I go from here? And I think, Vegas sort of became the place for these guys to go to create kind of a new atmosphere. And I should talk just for a minute about the history of Vegas, because as we know, you know, Vegas was started by some mobsters. Basically, it was a one-horse town in the middle of the desert in Nevada. But gambling was legal in Nevada, so that was the draw, and it was close enough to Los Angeles that people could make junkets out there. So they started it up in the 40s, and, you know, even in the 50s, it was still a pretty small town, and gambling was kind of, you know, frowned upon and this sort of thing. And a lot of this elevation of Vegas had to do with, you had the casinos, you had the showrooms, but it really, Vegas really took off in a big way when the lounge scene started to happen. And we could go do a whole show about Louis Prima, you know, at some point, because he's another great name. But he resurrected his own career by playing in the lounges. And the lounges were originally the place where a husband or a boyfriend could drop off his wife or girlfriend to go gamble, because it was very unseemly for women to be at the tables or even to be seen at the tables. It was a man's game. But once Louis Prima kind of came into these lounges, you know, which were these sort of drop-off points for the wives and girlfriends, and he was booked from midnight till 6 in the morning, they took the lounge and they made it into an entity of its own. And suddenly the lounge becomes the place to be seen in Vegas, and lounges spring up everywhere. When we think of the cocktail lounge in the modern sense, something that's attached to a restaurant or something that has a tiki theme or some other kind of mid-century modern you know, accoutrement, that's really where all this comes from, is from Vegas in the 50s. So suddenly, you know, gambling, drinking, after hours, like Vegas starts to take on this kind of thing. And Sinatra and all those guys would go see Prima, and they, you know, John Kennedy showed up in the 50s all the time to see Prima. And it sort of made the whole Vegas experience more casual, more intimate. If you went there, you might see somebody like Sinatra or Dean Martin or Sammy. So it's, you know, that's sort of what was happening in Vegas at this period and why the Rat Pack kind of, you know, sort of represented the pinnacle of that attitude.
Let's talk about the song you've chosen by Dean Martin being Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone.
Well, this is just a classic Dean Martin song off of a classic Dean Martin album. It's probably one of the most popular of the 50s. I didn't really have a live Dean Martin thing, but you just get that sense. Dean Martin was really the next generation of Bing Crosby. He loved Bing Crosby. He modeled himself after Bing Crosby. He was sort of this very smooth, but, you know, it was Bing Crosby with a cocktail. Bing Crosby was very kind of square and all-American. Dean Martin was a bad boy at the same time as he was that smooth crooner. And this tune epitomizes his delivery, you know, and what made him great.
Dean Martin and Nelson Riddle with that orchestra. Daniel, I'll just go back with some calls for a minute. Hello, Alex.
How are you going?
Yes, Alex.
I just wanted to say that I saw the last concert that Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr. and Liza Minnelli in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank was probably past his best, but he was still, you could see he was good, been fantastic, and that years ago.
Yep.
And Liza Minnelli was good, but Sammy Davis Jr. was just absolutely fantastic, I thought.
It seems to be the popular conception is that Sammy Davis Jr. was the best of the bunch.
Yes, well, he danced and he told jokes. He sang Bojangles, and he was just the best entertainer I've ever seen, for sure.
Alex, thank you. I'll just quickly go to Carolyn. Hello, Carolyn.
Hello.
Yes, Carolyn.
Last Saturday was our 45th wedding anniversary, and we have Sammy Davis Jr. to thank, because to get me to go out with him for the first time, my husband bribed me with front row tickets to Sammy Davis Jr. But before I'd say yes, I made him produce them.
So I'm not going until you show me the tickets.
That's right.
Was it good?
45. Oh, Sammy Davis Jr. is just magic.
Yeah.
He has magic feet, magic voice. He could do anything. You know, he just would sit down and more or less talk to people, and you just have the best night with him. It was fabulous. But the stadium was where we saw him, and it was a circular stage. It just kept revolving.
Amazing. Thank you. Daniel, was there any competition with them? Like, did Frank get a bit cranky if people like Sammy Davis Jr.? Was there any competition amongst the three of them?
Well, yeah, I mean, the last track we're going to play here, we're going to play a track from Sammy Davis Jr., but the very last track we're going to play is a live Rat Pack track from Vegas, and they would just tear at each other in a good-natured way. But, man, stuff today that would definitely, you know, arouse the politically correct police to come out, and they would not be able to get away with.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously Sammy Davis Jr. being black, they would make a lot of black jokes. Frank and Dean were Italian. And, of course, you know, in the 60s, being Italian in America, you were still really a minority group, you know, with, you know, Polish jokes and, you know, all that sort of thing. So, you know, Italian jokes. I mean, so they'd rib them about being Italian. They'd rib each other about being drunks. You name it. They would find things to pick on each other about. But it was all good-natured, and they all respected each other tremendously because they all were, you know, had grown up in show business, and they were all superstars. So, you know, it was great. And I would say that what a lot of your callers are saying, that, you know, as an all-around shaboom entertainer, you know, Sammy Davis, I think, held up the best of the bunch. And really right until the end of his life, he was putting out his top form. But as far as vocalists, you know, I prefer Sinatra. I mean, I think Sinatra stands head and shoulders as just purely from his singing instrument, his ability to deliver a song.
Let's play a little bit of
he's my favorite.
Sammy Davis. This is him doing a medley from West Side Story. We'll talk a little bit about it off the back of it.
Can I have a... Oh, but take a pocket, take a pocket, take a pocket, take a pocket, take a pocket.
little bit of Sammy Davis Jr. doing a medley from West Side Story with a fine little bit of bongo playing in the background there, Daniel.
Yep, well, there's a reason that I picked a song that features the drums. And but, you know, that song also, I just love that because it really shows, again, how diverse and what an amazing take on things Sammy Davis Jr. had. You know, he was an incredible dancer. He was into rhythm. He was a great singer. He didn't even need any accompaniment to sell you the most poignant, you know, medley of West Side Story songs, you know, hitting every kind of emotional high point and low point with just this bongo player. And I just love that track. So, and it's, again, a live thing, so people can get an idea of what he was like live.
Now, before we go out with the Rat Pack performing live, tell us a little bit about, because you are also a historian, and particularly with the drums, tell us a little bit about the project that you're operating and working on.
I'm currently at work on a pretty incredible DVD project that I call the Century Project. And the century that I'm talking about is the period between 1865, the end of the American Civil War, up to 1965, and the arrival of the Beatles and the British invasion to America's shores. And the reason I picked this 100-year period is that the drums and the drum set is a unique American invention. It was created in America. And this 100-year period shows the evolution from essentially marching drums all the way up to rock and roll. And it's not just about the drums. It really talks about the evolution of American popular music, because the drums go hand in hand, you know, with events that happen, slavery and segregation and immigrant groups coming to America and bringing their ethnic instruments with them. And so as all of these things unfolded, the Depression, World War II, the dawn of the teenager, you know, the drums and the drum set responded to all of that. So it's 100 years of music history as seen through the lens of the drummer.
Now, if people want to have a look at it, Daniel, where would they go?
Well, I'm using a really great website called Kickstarter.com to talk about the project. So if they go to Kickstarter.com, they can punch in my name, Daniel Glass, or the Century Project into the search window when you get to the website, and it'll pull up the whole page, and they can look at a video and everything and learn a lot more about it.
Good stuff. Now let's go out with the Rat Pack doing Birth of the Blues. Birth of the Blues with the Rat Pack. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure. And there you can hear Vegas in the 60s. It was out of hand.
Well, I'm having a great time, you can tell.
Yep.
Thanks very much. Daniel Glass joining us, drummer, author, and historian. Thank you to everybody who joined us on the program as well as we took a look at the Rat Pack on the program. Go to Kickstarter.com if you're wanting to find out about that piece of history in drumming history. This is Overnights.